We'll be in 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 10 through 15. I'll bring it up on the screen here. Hear the word of the Lord. And David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, "Is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s." And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see this man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. So in 1521, the Diet of Worms was called to order, and this was a meeting of the state and the church, because those were not differentiated in those times, and in Germany, and it was a trial for the monk Martin Luther, who had essentially been setting the land on fire with his ideas and publications, and that demanded reform in the church. Now, Luther knew that the last time someone calling for reform had been in this situation, that the last time it didn't end so well for that guy, his John Huss, and he was burnt alive at the stake. But Luther went because he wanted the chance to debate the content and the theology of the church and in his writings in the hopes that he could persuade at least some of the leaders in the church and maybe even the emperor, Charles V, who would be in attendance. And instead, when he arrived, he was told that he would be asked one question and one question only. "Will you recant of all your writings, of all your heretical writings?" they said. And so they said, "Look, we're not interested in debating with you." And they were intentional. Luther was a powerful debater. And so they were not going to give him airtime. So they said, "Look, we just want you to recant or we want you to die. Like, that's just, you know, that's all." Okay? And the trial, of course, is a sham. And so Luther would have certainly been executed if he had not been suddenly attacked and kidnapped on the road. The abduction, though, was actually a ruse that was organized by a German noble called Frederick the Wise or Frederick the Third of Saxony. And Frederick believed that Luther had not received a fair trial and was sympathetic to Luther, even though Frederick himself was a Roman Catholic. And he was a fairly devout Roman Catholic. He had an extensive collection of Catholic religious relics. I mean, I think it's upwards of 19,000 religious relics that he had in his collection. So it's really somewhat ironic considering the things that Luther wrote about relics when you think about it. But he hid Luther in a castle in Wartburg for about 10 months, and where Luther began translating the Bible into his native German language. And eventually, after that 10 months, he made his way back to his home in Wittenberg, and from there he would lead the Reformation efforts in Germany. Now, a question I'm going to pose to you tonight is, was Martin Luther's escape from certain death a product of human schemes or divine intervention? So we're going to ask that question and we're going to come back to it at the end. But in moments of great peril, it is hard to figure out what's going on behind the scenes. It's further hard to figure out what to do, what decision to make. I mean, when Luther was, they said, you need to answer. Will you, we imagine the courtroom scene, like Tom Cruise and A Few Good Men. "I want the truth," that kind of thing. But that's not what happened. Apparently, Luther got very quiet and said, "I need time. I need time." And even when the time come when he said and contested, but when he said that those famous words, "Here I stand, I can do no other," it still wasn't kind of this tremendous like, "Oh," it was kind of more of a with fear and trembling. He said those words. because he had to make hard decisions. What is the right decision to make in that case? And so we have this story here before David, who flees into enemy territory. I mean, he goes to the land of the Philistines in hope of shelter. And when he thinks he is in danger, he pretends that he's crazy in order to get booted out of the castle, and he's successful. And he escapes to safety. Now, we might scratch our head as to what we can learn from that story, but consider that out of these events, David wrote not one, but two psalms out of this event. Psalm 34 and Psalm 56. It is directly headlined, David wrote this about what happened with the king of Gath. The truth is that this text has much to teach us about Christian ethics and particularly the providence of God. And tonight we are going to see how David makes a dangerous decision, how he executes a daring deception, and ultimately receives a divine deliverance. And I hope you like alliteration because it's all D's all the way down. All right. And so we see in verses 10 and 11 that David makes a dangerous decision. But this decision he makes is what we can call a risky but reasonable gamble. The writer tells us the main problem in verse 10. David is fleeing from Saul. But you ask, well, where's David's faith, though? I thought this was a man. I mean, he's the guy who went up against Goliath. He can't face Saul. Well, a similar accusation was laid against one of the church fathers, Athanasius. When he was being persecuted for defending the Orthodox faith, particularly concerning the deity of Christ. And his enemies, the Arians, were kind of mocking him and calling him out for running away and fleeing. And his response, he says, look, if it's bad to flee, it's worse to persecute. He says, one hides to escape death while the other seeks to murder. He reminds him the scriptures at times says that to flee, but the bloodthirsty are the actual reason for all the trouble. And then he says, quote, if then they reproach me with my flight, let them be ashamed of their own persecution. He says, look, if you stop trying to kill me, I'll stop running away. And then he concludes by saying that the flight of the persecutor is a strong argument against the persecutor. And he says, quote, for no one flees from the gentle and the humane, but from the cruel and the evil-minded. David's flight is a condemnation of Saul, who unjustly seeks to murder David, who is now the Lord's anointed and the next king of Israel. This also functions as the underlying reason for why David does what he does. Why in the world would David walk into, you know, one commentator called this basically a buzzsaw, and just, you walk into a town of the Philistines and expect to walk out alive? Well, you must be pretty desperate. It must be pretty bad. Because it doesn't make sense. He goes to Gath. I'm going to pull up the picture of the map here. So, right above where that white dot is up at the center, that's where Jerusalem is. And that's where David is starting out. He's right there. And so he's at Nob, which is just north of Jerusalem. And so verses 1-9 are about when he goes to Nob and they get the consecrated bread from the priests, and he lies to the priests and says, oh, I'm here on a secret mission from Saul and I need some food. And you got a sword? Great. Thank you. And so he's going from there, and then he goes over to Gath. So that's where he heads straight over into Philistia. But there's something very special, particularly interesting about why David chose Gath. Gath is a town of the Philistines, of course. It's not that far, so it's, you know, maybe that's why he goes there. But there's some reasons that he shouldn't go there. Gath is the hometown of a certain large giant man that he killed with a sling and a stone when he was a few years back. And let's recall that David just came from Nob, where he got the sacred bread, and then he got that, what was that thing he got? Oh, Goliath's sword. Who David himself said was unique and readily identifiable. There is none like it, he says. So he's going to walk in there with Goliath's sword, I guess, on his back, because that thing's not going on his hilt. So it's going to go on his back or something, and people are going to be like, that's Goliath's sword. This must be David. Here's the guy that's going like, he's walking into Gath basically saying, hey, remember me? I'm the guy that routed all your forces that one day and when we rebelled against you. That's me. So why does David go? Well, because he's that desperate. Saul is on a search and destroy mission for David, and Israel is not a safe place anymore. And so David is taking a calculated risk. He knows the Philistines will not be glad to see him. They most likely will initially want to kill him, but they might sing a different tune now that David the mighty warrior is an enemy of the state. And presumably David is going to go offer his services to the king of Gath. And David is hoping that the king will be open to a kind of the enemy, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend kind of logic. And overall, David's reasoning is here, desperate times call for desperate measures. And when your best option is to go to the Philistines as an Israelite, you know things are bad. But then David experiences that moment when your past success derails your present plans. The servants of the king of Gath have heard of David. David was so successful militarily, they refer to him as the king of the land. They have even heard the song, the little ditty that got out that was topping the billboard charts of Israel when about how Saul struck down his thousands, but David struck down his tens of thousands. They're like, tens of thousands of what? Philistines. The point is implied but obvious that David cannot be trusted. And if he cannot be trusted, then he must be dispatched with, lest he add to his thousands in the inevitable remix of David's song that is to come if they let him live. In verse 13, we're told that David was in their hands. The heading of Psalm 56, he says, at the time when the Philistines had seized him at Gath. But there's also something else going on here. Because the Philistine advisors actually see better than the current leadership of Israel does. Because here indeed is the king of all the land. Essentially, the advisors in Gath are functioning as unwitting prophets of the Lord as they identify David as the king-elect who is currently the king in exile. Now, there are times when we may have to take a risk and there's no safe options open to us. If David does nothing, he dies. If Athanasius did nothing, he would have died. And so David does something risky, but really it was one of the few viable options left to him. And when we're desperate, we may have to make a difficult decision. Now, perhaps we may not be, you know, be on the run, hunted by the state, but maybe we've lost our job. And we can't get a new one, or things are getting tight, our marriage is on the rocks. So we've got to make some hard decisions, and we don't know what the right choice is. But we also have to know that taking a calculated risk means risking things, risking that things are not going to go the way that we plan. And this is what happens to David here. Right? He was hoping going in, but before he can even open up his mouth, they're like, okay, no, let's kill this guy. We know exactly who he is. And the king seems to be listening. And so David makes a dangerous decision and it backfires. But he follows that up with what we can only call a daring deception in verses 12 to 13. An alternative title is we could call this the humorous theater of self-preservation. David hears the advisors and he knows that they want to kill him. And so he feared the king of Gath because the king of Gath has the power to kill him and very likely would kill him. So David changes his behavior before him, pretends to be nuts. And so one could only imagine what that actually would have looked like. Him riding all over the doors like a crazy guy and drooling just all over himself. Why would David do this? Well, for one thing, David is by himself. It's only after this that all those 400 men gather to him. So David's running on his own right now. And so David uses the resources that he has in order to attempt to save his own life. And he may be playing on, pagan understandings of crazy people, Apparently, in that day and age, crazy people were thought, it's possible they could be nuts, but it's also possible they could be possessed by the gods. So they kind of, they would let crazy people live even if they wouldn't kind of let them hang out in the palace. It'd be kind of like just scoot along and just kind of move them out. So he's like, if I act crazy, they won't kill me. They'll just kick me out. And he was right. And so I think we can have a lot of sympathy for David here. Because when was the last time that, you know, you stood between life and death? You know, if you were in David's position here, what would you do? And so this is where we enter into what I like to call David's ethical dilemma. Did David sin in pretending to be insane before the king of Gath? Early on, church theologians said no. Augustine, who wrote in the 400s, wrote that he said, no. David, what David's doing, we should understand, is prophetic expressions and actions to be considered by the wise student because they are veiled figures or garments that will benefit the thoughtful student of Scripture as he meditates upon them and unlocks them. Sometime around early to mid 500s, another theologian named Cassiodorus wrote that David's spittle that goes down his beard is clearly the Scriptures flowing out of his mouth. Yeah, I'm not buying any of that either. So, again, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Never go full allegory. You're just gonna end up in weird places, weird websites, saying weird, crazy things. All right. Don't go there. Love Augustine, but he ain't right here. The text actually says David saw what was going on and he changed his behavior. He's acting insane, and part of his act was to drool all over himself and to mark crazy things on doors. And so this is a deception that he's doing. Now, there are others who say that David did sin because he breaks the ninth commandment here about telling lies, but God was merciful to David. And so the reasoning here is that deception is a form of lying, and God doesn't lie, and we shouldn't lie. So therefore, David did sin, but God is gracious, but don't lie because that's sin. That's very straightforward. And people still hold to that position even today. But it gets more complicated. And this is where like ethics nerds really get excited at this point. Because there are also those who say that since the Philistines are the enemies of Israel, it is acceptable in war to trick your enemy. You don't have to like walk right out in front of him and like, you know, is it sin for me to hide behind a bush so they can't see me so I can shoot them? You know, it's like, or attack them or surprise them. Can you surprise attack? Can you send half your force up one side and half your force to the other side? Is that sin to trick your enemy? Well, of course not. And so it's saying, look, they're always at war with the Philistines. So the rules of war apply here. It's not wrong to trick your enemy. And so David is within the rules of war to trick the king. And I think there's a lot that to say for that argument. But I think that my favorite argument, the one that I'm kind of more partial to, is the last one that I'm going to give you, which is it's kind of the real mind bender. But it's later on. This brings in Jesus, right? So in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is accused by the Pharisees. He and his disciples, the Pharisees accuse him of, and his disciples of breaking the law. And what did they do? Well, they, according to the Pharisees, they picked grain and ate it on the Sabbath, and Jesus healed on the Sabbath. And Jesus gave, basically, if you take Jesus' defense and you put it together from Matthew chapter 12, he says, he gives his first line of defense. He goes, hey, when David went to Nob, he and his men ate the consecrated bread, and that was fine. And consider the fact that that just happened in David's story that we're in tonight. So Jesus cites David at the temple eating the consecrated bread and his men. Secondly, he says, the priests break the Sabbath all the time in their service to God, and they are guiltless. It's not that they're guilty and God is gracious, it's that they're guiltless. They don't do anything wrong, even though they break the commandment. And third, he says, you Pharisees and any reasonable person is going to break the Sabbath out of necessity. If your donkey's in a ditch, you're going to get it out. And guess what? People are worth more than donkeys. But here's the key to Jesus' argument in that text. I'm going to pull it up here. He says, I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And so Jesus says that he is greater than the temple and that he is the Lord of the Sabbath. And at the heart of his lordship is this principle that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. That is, if you have to pick between the two, you go with mercy. If you can only have one, if you're so hard up against the wall that you either show mercy or you do sacrifice to God, you show mercy. That's what Jesus says. And so from this argument, we understand that the disciples were able to pick grain and meet their immediate need of hunger, though it technically violated the Sabbath. Apparently, they are just as guiltless as the priests who violated the Sabbath in their service to God. And so there's this principle here that's kind of this general principle here that we're seeing that is being established, that there's this, that it's possible for one to break a commandment of God without necessarily sinning against God. Because Jesus says the demands of mercy outrank the requirements of sacrifice. They're required to sacrifice. That was in the law. But he says, if you got to pick between the two, you go with mercy. The immediate hunger of the disciples outweighed the rules of the Sabbath, just as the work the priests were called to do outweighed the rules of resting on the Sabbath. Now, if you're unconvinced about this, one, that's okay. But also consider that by a merciless commitment to tell the truth, one can do incalculable damage. I mean, gossip, for instance, may be 100% true, but it violates the commandment to love your neighbor. Well, everything I said about him is true. You're like, well, it wasn't your business to say, right? This is why actually, when I first became a pastor, very early on, someone was just like, all right, so Christians hiding Jews, Nazis, go. You know, like, was that okay? They were lying about it. Is that all right? You know, things like that. And I was kind of like, I don't know. I got to think through that. Now I'm pretty clear on it, at least for my sake, is that I believe that those who hid the Jews from the Nazis and lied directly to the faces of Nazi officers were not in sin. They were absolutely not in sin. Because if they had been silent, they would have said, I'm not saying. Well, guess what? Their houses would have got searched and they would have got found. And if they told the truth, they would have condemned these men, women, and children to suffering and death. So they violated the ninth commandment in order to honor the sixth. They lied to protect life. And so this brings us all back to David. All right. Did David sin? Well, what were his options? Tell the truth and be killed. Right? Just own it and just die. Or act crazy and maybe save your life. And so he broke the ninth commandment in order to honor the sixth and preserve life, even his own life. Does this mean that martyrs of the early church were wrong when they allowed themselves to be caught or even sometimes turned themselves into the authorities to be martyred for the sake of Christ? No, absolutely not. They bear that faithful testimony and we honor them for their sacrifice. But neither will I condemn David's actions here any more than I would condemn the Hebrew midwives who lied to Pharaoh in order to save the Hebrew children, or Rahab who hid the spies and lied about it in order to save their life in service to God and the people of God, or the lesser known Jael who through her deception of the pagan military commander brought about freedom and victory for the Israelites. The point is not that because of David in, you know, this moment of life and death, he lied or tricked the king, that it's now acceptable for us to lie or to deceive others in order to get ourselves out of a bit of inconvenience. You know? So like if we get pulled over by the cop, now we're like, well, David tricked the king of Gath. So now I can lie to the cop. You're like, no, that's not what we're talking about. All right. If you're speeding, get your ticket. All right. Rather saying that if we find ourselves in dire circumstances, life and death situations, sometimes we are forced to make decisions that we would not normally make in service to something more important. And so we are still a people of the truth, who are committed to the truth, who are called to speak the truth in love. But we also have to remember, when push comes to shove and are back against the wall, our God desires mercy, not sacrifice. And so we see a dangerous decision, followed by a daring deception, that ultimately results in a divine deliverance. In verses 14 to 15. Now, it's interesting because the deliverance is expressed in one way, but it's really sourced in another. So the deliverance is, first of all, expressed with an annoyed king. And this is, if we were smiling at David's behavior before, we're chuckling when we read the words of the king of Gath. Because he responds to David's, being crazy by saying, look, I've already got my quota for crazies in my kingdom. I don't need any more. Just get them out of here. There's no miracles, there's no parting of the sea, there's no dreams, there's no plagues of frogs or fire from the sky. And on the surface, it looks as if maybe God had nothing to do with it. And more often than not, we have to recognize that it is ordinary people that really bring about the momentary deliverances that we experience in our lives. This is why we have hospitals and doctors and nurses and ERs and paramedics. This is why, because they save lives. They deliver people out of pain, suffering, and a premature death. But we know that, as David also knows, ultimately, even though the deliverance is on the surface expressed in the annoyance of a king, and it was accomplished through David's deception, we know the source of the deliverance, which is the providence of God. I mean, again, think about the fact that David wrote two psalms out of this scene. I mean, it's only five verses in the Bible, and it produced two psalms in the Psalter. And so this moment left this imprint upon him, and to think, how in the world did I get out of there? How did that work? And its conclusion isn't that, well, I better go to Vegas because I'm lucky, right? His conclusion is, God was behind it. Why? Because God is merciful. Because he desires mercy. And God is to be praised. And so David, even by the way he responds to what happened and how God delivered him and even used what David did in order to free him from his situation, in Psalm 34 and Psalm 56, David pushes back against those that say, well, unless we condemn David's actions here, then we're just encouraging people to lie. Because what resulted was not David going, I can get away with anything. I can lie. I can do all this. No, the result was praise. And him saying to the Lord, in all honesty, that probably shouldn't have worked. But you were merciful and kind and got me out of it. It is to your glory. And so this is all an interesting kind of ethical dilemma that we were musing on tonight. And it's interesting and I think helpful to debate some of these issues. But one Reformation writer I have a lot of sympathy with, he said his name is Johannes Bugenhagen. He said at the end of the day, it's kind of foolish to really just debate about this endlessly and to try to establish all these hard and fast rules on ethics based upon David acting nuts in Gath. He says, literally, we do not need to make their actions into law here. The point of this story, he says, is that, and David makes abundantly clear in his songs, is that David doesn't save himself by his trickery, but rather that God is the one who liberated him from his certain doom. And therefore, God is worthy of our trust. And we have to be careful here, because the lesson isn't that God will get us out of every jam by miracle or the mundane. The point of the story is that God will preserve his own people for his own purposes. And so sometimes God's people are miraculously or ordinarily delivered from the furnace or the mouth of lions or from the kings of Gath. And other times they're sawn in two. They're thrown into the animals. They're crucified on a cross. Because the greatest deliverance in which God demonstrated his desire for mercy over sacrifice was when he sacrificed his own son in order to show us mercy. And in doing so, he won for us the ultimate deliverance from eternal death. Yes, we face death in this life, and it will come in a moment, suddenly or at the end of a long sorrow. But the cross of Christ has delivered us from the ultimate power that death once had over us. So, this brings us all the way back to the beginning and the question I asked. Was it by the schemes of Frederick III, Frederick the Wise of Saxony, or God that saved Martin Luther? Was David saved by God or by his own cunning? Well, to some degree, you could say, well, the answer is yes, right? But we have to prioritize. That God used the mundane means of men to bring about the deliverance of his people. And if this is how, and this is our God, this is how he operates, and so therefore we should join David, who starts writing songs about how we should magnify the Lord, how our soul should exalt and praise him. Because as we see here, and we see especially in Jesus, that the answer to David's dilemma is that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. Let's pray.